Yeah, AI's gotten pretty crazy.
Just reminds me of like seeing the internet for the first time and you're like, how does HTML work? And they're like, look, view source. And I'm like, okay. And they're like, okay, now put it over here and use this hot dog editor. I'm like, what? Hot dog editor. You do Dreamweaver. And I'm like, okay, wait a second. And now wait, you reload. Okay, reload the page. Remember those conversations? Reload the page.
That's really good. Yeah, it's definitely feels like mid-90s discovering the web, and then mid-2000s of like we had Ajax, you had like a bunch of just came together.
Yes.
And it all just worked.
This Week at Startups is brought to you by Squarespace. Turn your idea into a new website. Go to squarespace.com/twist for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use offer code TWIST to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Masterclass. Learn from the world's best minds. Anytime, anywhere, and at your own pace. Get 15% off an annual membership to Masterclass at masterclass.com/startups. And Hampton. Are you a startup founder or CEO seeking expert advice? Join Hampton, the private, highly vetted community for high-growth founders. Get invaluable insights, connections, and support to accelerate your business at joinhampton.com/twist today.
All right, everybody. Really thrilled to have a long-term friend of mine, incredible entrepreneur, and part-time internet comedian. Aaron Levy is back on the program for his fourth appearance. Just to tell you how long he's been around. Episode 224 in 2022, episode 389, 2013, episode 1173, February 21. And again today, this puts you getting close to the Five Timers Club, Aaron.
What's the record?
Well, there are some journalists who have done like news roundtables on a regular basis. So taking them out, we do have a number of five timers. Andy Ratcliffe has been on, I think, five times. Glenn, the CEO of Redfin's been on maybe four or five times, but it's rarefied air.
Okay, that's a good club. All right, sounds good.
It's a pretty good club, and it's but Brian Chesky joined the First Timers Club just yesterday. Did a great episode, and convicted felon from Fire Festival. Was on. Yeah. And that was our first convicted felon.
If my PR team had known about that, I don't think I'd be on right now. So yes. This is remarkable that we snuck this one in.
We did sneak it in.
we're doing the felons now. This is okay. All right.
You know, Billy McFarland was like, I'm a super fan of yours. I've been tracking you since high school and I am turning it around. I mean, I learned a lot of lessons and I'm like,
what's he doing now?
Fire Festival too.
Oh, okay, good. He learned a lot of lessons.
Would you like to sponsor it?
Okay.
But he has $28 million in restitution. He's paid off $40,000. Okay. He's charging $1,800 an hour to do marketing for people.
Yeah.
So he's just basically like a marketing guy.
Yeah.
Who's two out of every $3 he makes goes to the government and restitution. He makes like 30 cents on whatever dollar he makes for the rest of his life.
Wow. Okay. So 20, 30 years from now, it's paid off and then he'll be making profit.
Exactly. So you target, I mean, it's kind of like a Series D company in Silicon Valley today. Yeah. Hey-o. But I wanted to have you on because you and I were just talking about, my Lord, AI is moving fast.
Yeah.
And Box, I was at my poker game last night and somebody said, well, Box is the obvious best company to incorporate AI because I mentioned you were going to be on the pod. So you got a nice shout out there at the poker game. Right. And I noticed you started sharing some demos. So I think just your general perception at the start here to level set of the impact of this technology and how quickly it's moving, because it does seem like this was a very slow kind of grind. And then very quickly became wildly impressive. So your thoughts on that as a technologist?
Yeah, I mean, I would characterize it almost exactly the same way, which is, and I think most people really deep in AI would probably say the same thing. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, 10 years we've been, you know, incrementally making this progress. And, you know, you had the Transformer paper 5 years ago, and it's like, well, you know, that's obviously a big unlock. And then you had GPT-2 and 3, and you know, I think we probably both played around with the early versions of GPT, the GPT versions, and it was like, you know, super interesting in terms of, oh, that's kind of cool, a computer can do that. But there was like, I certainly didn't have an aha moment of like, all of a sudden, this is going to be incorporated into all software. I thought it was like a really, you know, compelling, demonstration of what we can now do with text prediction and whatnot. And then obviously ChatGPT, kind of both the combination of its improved, 3.5 model and just the right interface, to capture the zeitgeist of what we can now do with AI and interact with AI. And so, so that combination, put us in a completely different conversation about where AI would be incorporated. And so, we'd been doing 7 or 8 years of work in AI, the challenge was every single use case the customer had, I want to understand my contracts, I want to understand my film scripts, I want to understand my blueprint files. Every conversation we had was a different AI model that you had to narrowly, kind of train and implement for that one use case. And so it never really scaled, because it would be like, if we were building on the web and every feature you wanted to build, you needed a different, tech stack or CPU for that feature. It just would never scale out to all the different, kind of scenarios we had. And, with GPT 3.5 and now 4, it's like, it can just solve all the things. So it can do the contracts and the film scripts and the press releases and the marketing documents and the blog posts. And so it just understands everything. And then you can implement it in these much more generalizable ways, which is a real breakthrough in terms of just, how many use cases we can now solve with AI.
So when you saw, Gmail 2018, 2019, predicting your next word or two, okay, pretty clever.
Yeah.
That's helpful. But it wasn't like an aha moment. What was your aha moment in the last couple of months where you said, okay, I need to, and I'm assuming this is the case, correct me if I'm wrong, I need to get the entire company dialed in 100% on this opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, the specific revelation was probably no different than anybody else on the internet. It's just, you can give it literally any prompt and, at 99% likelihood, it's going to come back with a response. Now, accuracy aside for a second, and we can get into kind of how we solve that problem. Just the fact that it will attempt to do everything was sort of the mind blowing moment.
Yes.
I remember, probably my first like big aha was, you initially start with use cases, which are like these like very straightforward kind of facts. Cause like we're so used to like, we go to Google and we type in a thing and then we get an answer. And so your first things are like, wow, like it's really cool that a guy had that answer. So it was like really basic questions of like, what's the better way to travel, between, X and Y place. And you're like, oh, wow, that's actually pretty cool. Like I thought through, you might have to wait at the airport for this long. And so maybe it's actually more efficient in this case to drive. And so that was pretty cool, but very fact-based. And then like when you start to give it things that are not fact-based, but actually things that it has to take two pieces of distinct information and kind of combine them and reason through it. Mm. Then I was like, that was really where I was starting to be, my head started to explode where, we were giving it like, Peter, Michael Porter, sort of five forces framework, which is this sort of competitive framework of how you think about suppliers and competitors, et cetera. And so take that concept and apply it to things that no one has ever done a Michael Porter five forces for ever, like in the history of the world.
Yeah.
And it just did a really, really good job. Like we were like, do Michael Porter's five forces on an airport. And it was able to take, one set of information it has and then combine it with a completely unrelated topic and basically completely exceed what even a human would probably have answered, for that. And that was the big breakthrough of like, okay, so this is not just going to be this sort of question answer engine of raw facts. It's actually going to produce new information for people and then become really an assistant where you can just go to it and ask it anything. And so that was, some more of the aha moments when you start to take and combine those two unrelated things and you're actually leveraging the fact that it has a wealth of knowledge within it way more than what any person would be able to keep track of. That's where you really get the power of it. And so then we said, well, what if we combine our data set with that and then you start to, kind of create new use cases that just never before would have been possible. And that's where we, sort of didn't like do a full company pivot, but but about as close as you do when you're, you know, 2,500 people. And we just said, okay, this is a big moment for us. We're going to go and incorporate this technology.
If you can tell from the podcast lately, we've been doubling and tripling down on Founder University at Launch. In fact, it's basically the future of our venture capital firm. And that's awesome because I'm working with a couple of hundred early stage founders really early and getting to see what tools they use. You know what tool they show up with most? They show up with Squarespace. They put up their first website instantly, quickly with Squarespace. And it's beautiful and it makes them look like $1 million. The thing you may not be aware of is that Squarespace, beyond the beautiful templates that make your company look like $1 million and that work on mobile, it's not just a pretty website. It is a powerful e-commerce platform now. And they have member areas. What's a member area? You know, people like to sell content now and premium content. It's a big business. Well, they have that built in to Squarespace and they don't take, you know, double digit percentages of your revenue like those other platforms do. And they also have appointment scheduling. So, you know, if you're doing a business where you're a consultant, you want to charge for your time, well, you have scheduling built into it as well. And this is the brilliance of Squarespace. It's going to look beautiful, as you know. So here's what I want you to do. Just head to squarespace.com/twist for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use the offer code TWIST. You save an extra 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. We love you, Squarespace. You know how it is. When you're a technologist, everybody in your family, your friends, your circle, your network come to you and say, hey, I got to get a website up. Can you find me a developer, a designer, a product manager? And you just say, you know what? Yes, I can find you all that and more at squarespace.com/twist.
How many customers, broadly speaking, do you have? How many documents are in the repository? And then how do you start this process of the very scary prospect, I think, for some customers of, oh my God, am I feeding my data to this? And is it going to wind up jumping the fence? Am I training the Box model or the OpenAI model? And are they going to use some corporate secrets in a strategy document? And then somebody else says, hey, how does Michael Border, you know, reinvent an airport and a new airport in New York? And that was their proprietary stuff. So that's like got to be objection or concern number one. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's start first with that. And then we can kind of talk about actually what we're doing. So first and foremost, just emphatically, first of all, every interaction you have with Box AI is explicitly you have to decide to use it as either a user or the enterprise. So we're never having AI kind of do anything in the background. Without your explicit, you know, kind of consent on using the service. That's the first thing. The second thing is that at least for all of the use cases that we're talking about right now, there's no training whatsoever. You're just using the AI model in its sort of stateless form as really a reasoning engine to be able to help us with natural language, you know, type tasks. And so there's no training of the AI model. There's no logging of the information that you gave the model so it can train later. All of that is done in this very kind of stateless, ephemeral way where we're just kind of asking the AI model to help us with the user's query. And then probably the third big element is just we have a very, very high standard for security, compliance, data privacy, just by virtue of our customer base, our, you know, very, you know, large enterprises across every industry, you know, hospitals, federal government, et cetera. And so we really, really take you know, security and privacy very seriously. So we're not, you know, trying to lean into any of the privacy elements from a risk standpoint. This is completely, you know, meant to be a very, very, you know, a conservative approach to how we're going to treat, you know, data privacy and compliance.
Now, certainly there must be some early adopting folks and some CEO calling you saying, hey, I do run this organization. I would like you to create a language model for me across these 4,000 employees. And I, as the CEO, God, King, or Queen, would like to be able to do queries or my management team across our entire corpus of documents. So is that on the roadmap? And are you starting to get those, you know, sort of I'm all in requests from your customers?
We are actually. And what's really interesting about this is it's not even... it's not the obvious sort of cut lines of, you know, kind of conservative businesses versus more aggressive businesses and you know, sort of unregulated. We're seeing that most CIOs, most CEOs are recognizing that, you know, AI is a real platform shift. This is much like, you know, mobile or the web in terms of we think about it as a platform shift. It's a scenario where where, you know, this is now me talking, but our customers are kind of reinforcing this, which is it's a general productivity uplift where we can use this technology to, you know, make decisions more effectively, find information faster, spend more time on the right areas of our business that only humans can do as opposed to computers could do better. And so we're seeing, you know, almost universal optimism about how to leverage this technology. Of course, there's a long list of, you know, items that you have to just go through from a compliance, security, privacy standpoint. But in general, it's you know, across our 110,000 plus customers, obviously, you know, we spend more time talking to some of the larger ones, but there's a lot of excitement around it. And you know, there's a lot of nuances though. So for instance, this idea of training, you know, a model with your enterprise data, it's actually not clear that is a problem that you know, we can really easily solve at the moment. Because when you train a model, you know, with proprietary data, it's very hard to sort of figure out, well, which things should we leave out of the data set because they might accidentally inform the model and then give up, you know, kind of sensitive information to, you know, the wrong employee, as an example. So we have to...
Permissions are paramount here. And permissions are in the previous file, subfile, organization are just not the paradigm that we have just shifted to. The paradigm is here's everything and...
Well, humbly, this is where we think we play a role, which is actually you do want permissions on the data that that the user is going to want to be able to query against. And the AI model is really used as basically this, you know, brain to understand the information that you're giving it that the user already is allowed to access. And you're using that basically AI model to reason through what that user can already access. So, you know, at least in today's architecture landscape, and there'll be, you know, different approaches that different companies take. The point is not to train a model on your enterprise data, because again, then all your permissions are going to be leaked into that model. It's to separate the underlying access controls that people have to information from the AI model, which you use as a reasoning engine for that data. And that's at least for our kind of use case, which is a lot of sensitive data, but you do want to be able to work through it with natural language. That might not be as relevant for maybe if you wanted to have it train against your code base where all of the engineers are allowed to see all of the code base. That's something where you might want to have then a kind of a specific enterprise.
A perfect
model.
Example would be legal and HR. The legal department, everybody being able to query the legal departments could be any kind of settlement agreements or confidential agreements.
Exactly.
Come up, and then somebody typing in, who are the most underpaid people at this company? And they're like, oh, it's me.
Who's the most
overpaid people at this company? Oh.
Yeah. So you can instantly imagine, like, past, like, 10 employees, you can't train, you know, your entire enterprise on you know, your entire enterprise data set on a single model. So this is basically where our work has gone. It's only, you know, we're only 4 months into it, but it's gone to this abstraction layer where we can... keep the access controls in place, but use an AI model to reason through information that the user is allowed to access. And we think that's going to be the breakthrough for how we implement this.
Makes total sense. The head of human capital has access to all of the human resources information, but a recruiter might have only access to 10% of the information, and they might do different queries about different data sets and summarize or whatever. So how about some demos here of, you know, the... I would suspect there are things that are really easy to implement and provide massive value. You know, like we like to do as product people, we put those on an XY chart. Those would be like the quick wins.
Yep.
Big impact. Everybody's going to use it and it's easy to implement. What did you get to first? And then we'll get to the harder ones.
Sure. So this is fun going back to like the startup roots of a forced live demo. So, here's basically how it works. So I'm in my Box account right now, just looking at one file. And this is actually, it's a little meta because this is the press release for the announcement, but it's just an easy kind of public document. So so this is the press release and you'll be here, you know, you just click this Box AI icon. We're still going to continue to play with the ways that this gets incorporated in the product. But for now, it's this sort of chat interface on top of your content. And so now, you know, this would work whether it's a 3-page document or a 500-page document. But again, for demo purposes, we want to keep this simple. And you just say, you know, please memorize this announcement, and if it works pretty quickly, because we're in a dev environment, it'll just go in and summarize the announcement. And then you say, what are three use cases for Box AI? And so the key is, it's saying, according to this document, here are three use cases. So it's not attempting to kind of go into the large language model and say, what do you know about Box AI and can you respond to it? It's just saying, from this document, what are you finding inside of this piece of information that could answer this query? So that's sort of the way that we've set the prompting up. And that also then dramatically reduces kind of hallucinations that you might see, because it's not attempting to make anything up. It really is, we're really kind of forcing it to stay, within the document. But there's one cool thing, which is while we're telling it to only answer questions based on the document, we're giving it a little bit of free rein when you want to do more transformative type use cases. So let's say you want to take this document and turn it into something. We're instructing the model to go along with that. So as an example, we'll just see if this works out to prove my point or not. Please write an email to an automotive company pitching Box AI, and please include three auto specific use cases. So in this query, this information is not in the document, but we're having it go along with that instruction to say, use this source information to answer this question still. We'll see if it kind of comes up as a desired answer. It wrote this email to an auto company about use cases that they might have for Box AI. And so now you can imagine, you're a sales rep and you're looking at, a product marketing, PDF, and you really quickly want some ideas in front of a customer of like, so what are some use cases for this new technology? Box AI would be this assistant for you to go and quickly, answer that question. Any kind of tasks we give it, other than just using the large language model as the sort of database of answers, it will generally do on your content. And then,
Well, I was going to say, when you have a good demo like this, your mind starts to just come up with ideas.
Yeah.
And I was immediately like, who in the organization has to approve this? And I wonder if I can connect this to my email, and I can source 100 leads from the database who haven't been contacted. So you start to get into information you probably have, which is the org chart and the permission. So you could be asking, who handles the automotive category on our sales team in the United States? Can you get them to approve this? And in our Salesforce or wherever that data is stored, can you get me, all the sales leads in automotive that haven't been contacted this year?
Yeah,
boom.
Yeah, exactly. And so your mind can instantly kind of extrapolate now what's possible. Now, what's interesting is this is where, we in the Valley and everybody, figuratively or literally, have to respect that the technology can do all that, but we're probably like 5 years away from society actually understanding how that would all come together and having the technology actually integrated in this kind of capacity. And so this is where, and I remember when we were first, rolling out, cloud to enterprises. It was, 06, 07, 08, we were in front of enterprises and we had our early adopters and my hunch was like, okay, in like 3 years from now, obviously every single enterprise workload will be in the cloud. It's so clearly obvious to the entire world how much more efficient this is, how much more scalable it is, how much more secure it is. And, fast forward, it's now, 15 years after that prediction and we're still in the phase of like mass adoption of cloud computing. And the reason for that is just like, the world takes a lot of time to change on these really big tectonic shifts. And so, the use case you just mentioned, it's got to connect email and Salesforce and your data from Box. That's going to be a lot of wiring together that we have to come up with. And then what'll be interesting is, do the AIs talk to each other? So does the Box AI talk to the Salesforce AI, which talks to your email AI, and they are coordinating, that information exchange, in a secure way. We're at the starting point of how does that actually get architected?
One of the reasons why criticism can feel obnoxiously aggressive is that sometimes people use criticism to sort of dominate or assert superiority. And that is not helpful criticism. So state your intention to be helpful.
That was radical candor author and friend of This Week in Startups, Kim Scott. And she just did a masterclass session called Tackle the Hard Conversations with Radical Candor. If you're a business leader, you can learn so much from masterclass. There are amazing lessons from Bob Iger on leadership, Chris Voss on negotiations, and our friend Alexis Ohanian on startup investing, and so much more. Legends of their craft are on masterclass teaching you whatever you want to learn. Paying for an unlimited masterclass subscription is a total no-brainer. We just had an awesome insight from Kim in just 15 seconds. Imagine how much you're going to learn in 10 minutes or an hour or maybe two if you invest that in the next couple of weeks. I highly recommend you check it out. Get unlimited access to every class. And as a Twist listener, you can get up to 35% off for Mother's Day. What a gift. Go to masterclass.com/startups now. That's masterclass.com/startups to get 35% off for Mother's Day. Yeah, this guide on the side concept feels really powerful in terms of just efficiency. When you look internally at your own company, what would you predict if I had to ask you in a percentage basis that the average team member or the entire organization, how much more efficient will they be by the end of 2023?
Yeah.
If you get everybody to adopt using ChatGPT and other AIs, how much more efficient will your company be?
Yeah, this is the big question, I think, for all of us. And so if you kind of imagine, let's say every knowledge worker for now, just starting out with that demographic, has an AI or multiple AI assistants that do relevant tasks for them. Workday will have one for HR, Salesforce has one for sales,
Notion,
Copilot. Everybody has kind of AI incorporated their workflows. I think the way that we should think about it for now is how much time do you spend in your job trying to triage information sources, find answers to questions, sort of do more information based tasks, writing something, brainstorming something, discovering something, depending on the job, if you're in, let's say, customer support, that could be like 50% of your time because you're always going back to the knowledge base and, trying to get an answer to something. If you're an engineer, you'll go talk to engineers and they're spending, two or three hours to find like who on the internet has optimized this particular SQL query before. And theoretically instantly solved inside of GPT-4 or Copilot. And that just becomes this unlock. And so I think depending on what your job looks like, somewhere on that continuum is you might get back 50% of your time. You might get back 20-30% of your time, and my kind of like totally amateur hour macroeconomic view of that is that we won't really even notice how to measure that because the that engineer or that customer support rep will just be doing they'll just get to the next task faster.
They'll get down the roadmap faster. They'll get to the next sales call faster.
Exactly.
So it's not and eliminating their position. It's augmenting them.
Totally.
And when I talked to Brian Chesky about this, you know what number he came up with?
What?
30%. And I had come up with 30% because I was
of efficiency improvement?
Across all of Airbnb employees. And I just thought about that. Well, hiring has been in that 10 or 20% a year range. So on a meta prediction, I think you could see organizations, instead of trying to hire somebody, to throw a body at it kind of management culture, I think the next 2 years of management culture, who knows how long, will be, how do we get the AI to do this? Is there a prompt we're missing? Is there a different AI tool? Should I be using Poe from Quora? Is Bard going to do a better job? You'll be just AI shopping, chatbot shopping. And I think 30% is the right number. I think it's
So I think that this will be extremely interesting to watch, clearly, but I think there's a couple ways to cut it. So there are some tasks in a business that are not kind of like infinite. They just have this one discrete thing has to get done. So if you make that one discrete thing 30% more efficient, then you scale that out and then almost by definition, you would have 30% less labor. Mm-hmm. Across the economy or across a particular business for that thing. But then there's a lot of tasks that are not kind of finite. They're they are like literally kind of, you know, bottomless and boundless in terms
ongoing.
Of
ongoing. Yeah.
Ongoing. And so I think engineering is one of those things, which is we are always constrained. We are universally always constrained by the number of engineers we have. And so if I can make our product roadmap go 20 or 30% faster, that does not, that we are going to hire the same number of engineers that we can afford. We're just going to accelerate the we're just going to be on a relative basis to what we would have been doing, 30% more productive.
Yeah.
No different from 10 years ago, we were probably 30% less productive then because we had engineers working on, you know, different open source libraries or different, you know, systems that now the cloud just does for free for us. But we didn't hire fewer engineers as a result of that efficiency. We actually, if anything, we hired more engineers because they could actually go and do more productive tasks as opposed to these sort of lower level, maybe less differentiating tasks. And so I think for areas of your business where there's no particular upper limit, there's no upper limit on how many sales reps you need, how many engineers you need, how many account customer success, you know, managers you need, because those things are only constrained by how many customers you have or, you know, how innovative is your company and your roadmap. And so I think these just become accelerants into the future. And then there are going to be areas where there was a finite limit that you actually need, and we can make that area of the business more efficient. But I think there's more areas of businesses that are boundless and kind of limitless than those that are, you know, inherently finite.
Yeah, I agree strongly, because if you just think, I was trying to think of which category would be one that could be like telephone operators, you know, like, okay, that's just completely been replaced, or, you know, travel agents who book your tickets for you, right? And they type in the search instead of you doing, okay, obviously those went away. And then I just thought, well, okay, maybe customer service or success. And then I thought about it and I was like, you know what? You're always trying to get a customer to be more successful with the product.
Right.
So instead of dealing with login issues or navigation issues, those will be done by the AI.
Yes.
But then you'll be getting to, like, here are some scenarios for you to use our product. Here's some, you know, advanced scripting stuff you can do with this product. You're going to just go to the higher level stuff that makes people churn less. And it just feels like there's going to be a group of people who resist this, but I don't think they should be scared. I think this is like an incredible opportunity. It feels to me like we just went from dial up to broadband.
Right.
All that did was increase joy, you know, and usage. When this is going to speed up developers, I think the developers are going to be stoked to be more efficient and get more done.
Yeah, there's no developer that I've talked to that has been using any form of AI for productivity that has been like, I really wish I could go, you know, do that research again of how people, you know, optimize this query or how they interact with, you know, this external library or API. Like at no matter what, everybody is like, if I could just see a quick example of you know, how everybody on the entire internet solved this problem, I'm going to be able to leap forward faster. It doesn't mean you like copy and paste the code and you just implement it, you know, without any additional labor. But the speed of which now you can jump to the next task and the ideation you have is just so much faster. And so I don't think there's any returning, you know, from that. But I'm way more in the optimistic camp of this just acts as a general productivity lever for the economy.
Yeah. This feels to me like the way out of whatever economic situation we're in, just like mobile broadband. It just kind of helped the economy, and founders get enthused. I mean, I can hear the enthusiasm in your voice. You're in the office on a Friday, you know, just getting it done. And are you feeling that the enthusiasm level inside the org has gone up? Because listen, it's been a tough 18 months, stocks going down, layoffs in big tech. Is this changing morale?
Yeah, I mean, we have, you know, we've been in kind of hunker down mode for 3+ years. We went through an activist battle, and so we've kind of already had this grinded out, you know, kind of mindset. So fortunately, that's been kind of baked in. But I think, you know, independent of our specific, morale on that front, I think this is sort of what we all live for in tech, is like, you want there to be a platform shift at some interval, you know, 10 years, 15 years, that just shakes things up. And you just, I mean, it's exciting that the companies you thought were monopolies now are, you know, they actually have, you know, real, you know, strategic crises that they have to go solve. There's an all new technology that is just really fun to play with. I mean, most of the work that went into Box AI was, you know, these are like 1 a.m. sessions,
awesome.
You know, with the team or CTO on like, okay, how do we solve this? And how do we figure this thing out? We hired an intern at midnight on a Saturday, and just, you know, some kid at Stanford that was just like online and ready to rock right away.
Love it.
So it's just like, those are like the fun. I mean, I'm probably being like overly nostalgic in our strategy here, but like that's what makes startups fun is, you know, something comes out of left field. You have to adapt to it. You have to figure out, you know, is this a tailwind or a headwind? How do you incorporate the technology? The other fun thing about AI specifically is that it has the surface area of it is just so large where like every day either somebody externally is doing a discovery that opens up, you know, we saw the auto GPT thing just you know, a month ago and you're like, okay, well, that's a whole new vector of innovation.
Yep. Plugins.
Well, the plugin
data
architecture
analysis.
With
did you use a data processor yet?
I have not used that one. Is that pretty nuts?
Pretty cool? Like you upload a CSV file and you're like, it's like, okay, here's the columns in it. And you're like, okay, tell me about the data. And it's like, tell me three trends. And it's like, okay, it seems like, and I just uploaded like an Airbnb CSV of like all the different LA things. And it was like, it seems like Santa Monica has more than this place and this, you know, and the average price is this. And I'm like, whoa, I was like, make some charts. And it's like, okay, here are some charts. And somebody did it internally. We were doing diligence on a startup and we just took the diligence folder and took their revenue and projections and everything and said, make some charts and tell us about this. And it hallucinated. There were some bum charts that didn't make any sense. You're like, this makes no sense. But then there were some that were like, oh yeah, that would be something that an associate in a venture firm would spend 2 hours on. And you know, the researcher just did it. And it's like, okay, great.
It's totally crazy. And the fun thing is actually like, you know, even the demo I just gave you are kind of like the obvious things that you would do with AI. But when you start to think about like the non-obvious stuff, and actually part of our problem is just going to be how do we help encourage people to leverage this in these non-obvious ways? That's where it gets really fun. So one scenario, we gave it like our earnings script from one quarter. And we said, you know, if you were Warren Buffett, how would you improve this earnings script? And
nice.
And so it's just like a random use case. Like nobody in the entire world would ever have, you know, asked that question of an earnings script, but all of a sudden it starts to amp up the cash flow message and the share repurchase message and the capital allocation message. And so now, you know, when you're preparing to go in front of a whole bunch of financial analysts, and you want to, you know, figure out what's the right tone, what things should we lean into, you have this instant expert that's seen the entire world of finance. Everything ever written online about, you know, every earnings call, every, you know, ever, and you have that now instantly at your disposal. And so, you know, if you have a little bit of imagination on how you can start to incorporate AI, you know, per your due diligence use case or any way that you want to work with your data, literally there's just not a limit to what you can do with this stuff.
The most interesting thing I've found is when you push it to become more creative and you say, give me five ideas that nobody's ever thought of before. Give me 10 ideas that are crazy. And like you literally use words like this and it's like, okay, permission granted. And like then the genie starts doing your wishes and you're like, whoa. When you're the founder of a high growth startup, things can get chaotic. We all know that. You face a ton of questions. You got problems all day long and you don't know the answer to everything, especially if it's your first time as a startup founder. But you don't have to face these issues alone. That's where Hampton comes in. Hampton is a highly vetted private community exclusively for founders and CEOs like us. Hampton's mission is to create the most valuable and engaged community for high growth founders. Here's why. Some Hampton members have already called it life-changing. When you join Hampton, the membership team over there carefully handpicks 7 other members to join your core group. This group is like your own personal board of directors. They provide you with advice, critical feedback, and will aim to help you accelerate your growth. Hampton members run some of the fastest growing startups in the world, and you probably use their products and services like Morning Brew, Blank Tree Coffee, Dribble, and more. The connections, personal accomplishments, and a sense of belonging are what make the Hampton membership special. And you know, community is super important. It can get very lonely out there as a startup founder. So here's a very simple call to action. If you're ready to scale your business, join the Hampton community today at joinhampton.com/twist. That's joinhampton.com/twist today. joinhampton.com/twist today. I don't know if you've been following the writer strike, which started this week in Hollywood. Yep. And on page two of like the update to their members, the last like item before like the coffee and donuts or something completely meaningless in their negotiation was, we're asking for a ban of AI to write scripts, to ingest previous scripts, and to use it in the future to create derivative works. And then there was like what the studios said back to them. The studio essentially was like, we will agree. Their counter was, we will agree to do a yearly meeting on new technologies. And I was like,
yeah,
you know what you need to do, writers? And I just took, I asked it to come up with, just for giggles and to, you know, put it on Twitter. I said, give me like five themes about Biden and five themes about Trump that a late night writer for a late night talk show could use to brainstorm jokes. And it was like, yeah, Biden, you know, sometimes makes gaffes and he loves ice cream and Trump uses weird words and he's a narcissist and he's addicted to Twitter. And I was like, okay, well, that nailed it. Then I said, oh, do a Twitter exchange between the two of them. That's funny. And it started making some, and they weren't zingers, like they weren't ready for prime time, but they were good brainstorms. And so I guess the question is like, did you get early access for your Twitter? Because you're hilarious on there. And like, what impact is this going to have on your joking on Twitter?
I think I have not yet fed it any Twitter stuff on, and you know, Twitter is its own vector of landscape chaos right now. But on the writer strike thing, here's the thing. I'm actually super sympathetic to any demographic that thinks that AI is going to have an impact on their job, simply because it is this foreign technology coming out of nowhere. Nobody wants to feel vulnerable in everything they've learned their whole life. So I'm of the view that these are super important conversations. There's not like an obvious thing of like, you know, Silicon Valley is really going to have to, you know, trying to avoid the kind of like, oh, I, you know, what,
learn to code.
Yeah, exactly. It's like we have to be thoughtful about these kinds of trends. The reason I'm optimistic is just because I think there's still, you know, to even your point, like they weren't zingers, I think there's a lot of stuff that you know is still in this, like it's novel because it's new, but it is not actually going to, you know, really be able to go and replace the level of creativity that a human has for the vast majority of ways that you know we actually pay creative people for, you know, today. And I think there's a kind of a little bit of a divide. I think there's the use case that you'll see from something like Midjourney, which is you know, really, really compelling, you know, images. And I think the scenario there is that we just end up having more ubiquitous creativity from so many more people, but the experts get even better. And the idea generation increases, you know, tenfold across the world, because now you can be, you know, some random kid in high school and you could, you know, be ideating on a new product, you know, design that would never have, you know, existed in the world, but now you have this AI engine that can help you with that. So I think creativity just explodes because of this. And on the you know, and more of the professional trade side, I'm just bullish long term on humans really, really like other humans to create things. And
of course.
And it's just totally different to imagine going to a movie that AI generated from, you know, something that Quentin Tarantino made.
Of course.
And so I just don't think that our brains are wired to care about you know, if a human didn't make it, but and the field is entertainment, I'm skeptical that that's going to replace, you know, what the humans are doing.
If you look at CGI, they thought, okay, this is the end of acting, this is the end of, and it's like, yeah, Blade Runner and Star Wars use miniatures,
right?
Amazing. And then you go back and you look at the miniatures and you're like, eh, it's kind of taking me out of the experience, like,
right,
it doesn't look that good. And then you see CGI today and you're like, you know what, we can make you a Star Wars series every 3 months for you and your kids. And so are there less creative people? No, there's more.
Right.
Because now you can go down the long tail of content and you can make the Ahsoka series about Anakin Skywalker's Padawan. And it's like, okay, great. Go for it.
Well, actually, I mean, exactly to this, right? Like this is actually, I mean, remember, I mean, you know, 06, 07, and 08, we thought like, you know, well, we're just going to be watching YouTube and UGC is going to disrupt all Hollywood. And like all the tech people were like, oh, this is the end of Hollywood. And it's like, no, like if anything, it actually, you know, contrasts the quality of the really good stuff even better. And we get just as excited or more excited about the good content. And so to your point, I mean, AI is an enhancement to that creative task, but from everything I've seen, not a replacement of.
It's going to do something great for startups too. Like when we started, what did you spend on your original logo? This is like a question you can tell like when a founder started the company and how much you spent, because in the to that aughts or whatever they call them, like you would actually pay to get a logo done in all likelihood. And what did you, do you remember what you paid for the first Box logo?
I actually designed it. It was free in our case, but,
you were cheap.
But yeah, I mean, that's a
few, you know,
$5,000-$10,000. I probably spent 20 hours just rounding each of the letters.
Yes.
So way too much time. It would be way better to have it had a computer.
But you got
to do
quoted
that.
5 to 10.
Oh, easily. Yeah. Yeah.
And you were like, well, I have more time than money, so I'll just do it myself on the weekend. And now, you know, then there was like this medium period where like these websites, Dribbble, Behance, whatever, Fiverr, you can find all these folks and you can get a logo that's reasonable. There were design competitions like 99 Designs and other ones for like $500, $250 bucks. And the designers were really upset about that. But if you're doing a high-end logo, like you're still can charge $5,000 or $10,000. There's people who will pay it. Like if Box is going to do, did you ever do your logo over again and do like a whole brand treatment in the last 10 years?
No, but I'm not trying to ruin your questions, only because
you're just that cheap.
We're either that cheap or we do that all in-house. And so,
But the
theme is completely accurate. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And I think like this Uber redid their whole pack. I remember Travis redid all of Uber at some point. He hired an outside firm. It probably cost $500,000 or something like that. Yeah. It's like, well, we can afford to do it. We want to have a thoughtful discussion about it. And yeah, I mean, AI can make a 7 out of 10, but we want a you know, 9.5 or 10 out
right.
of 10. We're going
right.
to go that way. And
right.
I bet you all these writers are already using ChatGPT to brainstorm ideas, just like they took out old joke books or old scripts and look for ideas, or watch old Kurosawa movies and decide like, hey, this was an interesting character set from Fortress. So well, let's do R2-D2 and C-3PO for the next generation.
Yes. So, yeah, I think that's my take. I think the one asterisk that I'll add is just
okay.
I do think the copyright piece is super interesting. So
say more.
Just these AI models are trained on everything they can get their hands on.
Seems unfair to you?
You thought Barry Diller was like, you know, now is the moment you have to, you know, fight if you are a content creator. And so I think we're in for you know, a couple of years of really, really interesting, you know, case law, you know, coming out around what how this all plays out. So,
where do you stand on it? Somebody trains on every, you know, song ever written, and then they make new ones. That seems profoundly unfair to me. Getty Images busted Stable Diffusion like instantly. That was like, dude, you literally blurred the Getty image. Like, come on, bro. Like, that's just not cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oops.
I
Where does it hash out for you? What do you think would be fair?
The problem is that you know, fair is somewhat different from technically possible, and so we're gonna have to figure that out.
Yeah.
You know, I think the like intellectually like ideal outcome would be something where you know data gets licensed to model training
easy,
and there's a, you know, we all put a little tag in our website that says you can train our public information or you can't. And then
robots.
This is just
.txt for AI.
Exactly. It's AI.txt. And I
Perfect.
Think that, and then what is the new Creative Commons for that? And actually then probably as a result of that outcome, you know, the models will be basically as good as they are today because there'll be enough information that is in more in that public domain. And maybe, you know, it's just not as good as Quentin Tarantino scripts. And that's sort of the one
or,
gap. Yeah.
I mean,
they license it.
Yeah, I think there's an opportunity there. So you start thinking about it as an opportunity. Newspapers are struggling, right?
Right.
All kinds of content creators are struggling. You look at something like Reddit, you look at something like Quora, you want people to participate in those communities. So licensing Quora, licensing Reddit, and then you'd have Google and Microsoft and Facebook all competing to who gets the Reddit corpus, who gets the Twitter corpus. Maybe they give exclusives, maybe they don't.
I'm going to pour a little water on that one, unfortunately, because you can also imagine that the costs of running these models or training them will become so high that it all of a sudden drops the productivity that you get from using them. Because like if the price of a token were 10 times more expensive because it had only licensed data within it, a lot of the use cases I just demoed, an example, would be a lot harder. And so to just do in any kind of affordable way. So then what would happen is you would end up having You know, more of these public domain large language models would probably be the ones that end up taking off. It's a nice theory that everybody could just start charging for this data, but then the models would ultimately then get trained on the stuff that was cheap, because it would just be, you know, we can't have, I don't think you could have the equivalent of the, you know, the Comcast, negotiation wars with, you know, X cable, you know, station, cable channel, like for AI models, because the many to many problem on that one is just going to be insane. Yeah. So imagine, you know, somebody comes in, Reddit says, well, we're going to pull our data and you've got to pull it out of your model. It's just
an impossibility. I mean, basically, yeah. if Getty Images wins an injunction, like damage is being caused, they could get like this injunction, a preliminary injunction against Stable Diffusion. They got to just turn the model off and start over. I mean, that would be wild.
It's going to be totally wild. So I have my popcorn, we're going to stay out of that one and just we'll use whichever AI model is legal. So
I like when the industry comes up with something like self-policing, like robots.txt. So I think your idea, AI.txt, is a great start. Yeah. And then, you know, a little bit of cash here and there, and then citations. I noticed I have been grinding on about this, which, like, I don't have a problem with you using my stuff, but can I get a link back? That's just courteous. And in the new version, have you played with the web ChatGPT-4?
Yeah.
It's kind of janky. It crashes constantly. But when you hit the dropdown, it shows you what web pages it's crawling out on the web. It shows you what search it did, and it links to it.
Yes.
So I thought that was kind of dope. I was like, okay, at least I can link back to that and they get some traffic or whatever. But I think this brings like a really interesting micropayments concept. This is where I think Google, I'm curious your thoughts on like Google's vulnerability right now, because that was like the big topic last night at the poker game. I feel like this could be like Google's way of actually cementing in like some revenue sharing with the people they index, where if I use you in an answer, I give you a fraction of a penny.
Right. Yeah. Super interesting. You could certainly imagine a world where they strategically would want to kind of make it very, very hard for any subscale player to you know, commercially operate. And so, you know, if you were really, really like, you know, game theorying this out, like you'd want to be on their policy team being like, oh, we've got to really lock down the copyright issue because they're you know, then you'd have to be at their scale to go and actually do that.
Yeah.
I still don't, my brain can't figure out how you do the kind of like sub penny, you know, type model, because even in the example you just mentioned, which is the web browsing thing, that one's easier to do because it's pulling out the web pages and then using the AI model to reason through them. So then you obviously know then what it's citing. You know, if you interact with the AI model directly, and in a sort of black box fashion where it's not connected to the internet, I don't know how we, you know, eventually track like what portion of the model,
Condé Nast Traveler versus New York Times travel section.
Exactly. Like,
yeah. But you know, that sometimes these problems are opportunities. All I can say is, and I think you'll agree with me, thank God this is the platform shift and not crypto and not VR. Because, oh my Lord, the two most annoying people I've ever met are people with VR headsets trying to get you to put them on and crypto people not shipping products. Thank God. That's something.
I've rested my case on crypto last year, so I've been able to move on from the topic. But
I mean, it's just unbelievable. Like this, speaking of hallucinations, like, has so much money been pumped into a space with so little to show for it?
Yeah, I think the challenge with crypto is basically like the you know, there's been tweets over the past couple of years which is like, what's the best, you know, demo that you can do of crypto, and then like somebody will record something or show something, and it always requires you to be bought into a philosophy as opposed to caring about the use case itself. So you're wowed by the fact that, you know, with no intermediary I could do X thing. But X thing is not like, wasn't like a new thing that you couldn't do before. It was just a thing that we already do, but now with no intermediary. And so the problem is like translating that to regular consumers, like there's not enough bandwidth to tell people why they should care about that philosophy. Cause they just like, no, I just feel like I can already move money to people. I can already, you know, communicate.
I can order a cup of coffee with my watch. I can use Apple Pay.
Yeah.
And this is better. Why?
You really had to care about the underlying architecture to get bought in, and versus, you know, something like AI is like, you just show people like the thing and they're like their mind explodes and they're like, I like what genie
give me
is,
more.
Is, yeah, exactly. What genie
when can
is
I get
pr- produce this? My mom is, you know, she keeps asking me like, you know, can I, well, she's asking me to do the ChatGPT queries. But like she keeps asking me for, can
also
you
the laser
GPT
printer
to,
in the basement, Aaron.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's jammed again.
That's customer where we're at. Support? So it's a pretty good test. If you know, we have, you know, people texting people to ask ChatGPT to run a request for them. So that's like when you cross the chasm in technology.
When is all this going to be available on Box? And how are you going to charge for it? Because I just got a bill from Notion. I had all of my team sign up for ChatGPT-4. I said, pay the $20, put it on your personal card, put it on your corporate card, whatever. Just start playing. There's no like multiplayer buy mode or whatever. There is in the sandbox. I did that too, but not for the actual consumer product. But then Notion was like, hey, you're paying like this amount per month, but the AI is $20 more per person and $10 per more person. I was like, I got to make that decision now.
Right.
ChatGPT-4 or the Notion version of it. It's embedded. I like both.
Yeah.
Do I just spend $250 on each individual in my organization a year and it's $500? I'm like, maybe I'll just buy both.
Yeah.
When is this going to be available? How are you going to charge for it?
Yeah, I think you actually got to the heart of the issue of why, you know, why you'll have you're actually going to have competition driving prices down as opposed to up, vis-a-vis that licensing question, because the only reason Notion is charging you so much is because, you know, the amount of tokens that they're outputting, you know, from the AI model are, you know, pretty vast and also unpredictably broad, you know, depending on which user is using it. And so they have to charge more for the product. For us, you know, our goal is to incorporate some degree of the technology into the core of Box, so that way as many people as possible can leverage it. And then for things that are extremely high volume, you know, we'd probably have to have some additional monetization. But we think about this more as a scale play of like, how do we just completely, you know, transform the product overall. But TBD on some of the specifics on that.
Yeah. When will it be available, or when do you
think
it's shipping?
It's rolling out right now. What I just demoed we're starting with a number of kind of private beta customers. We want to get the user experience right. We want to, again, figure out that kind of pricing and performance side. And then I would say the coming months and kind of quarter or two, it would be GA.
All right, listen, continued success. Congratulations on getting back to the office. You got people back in that beautiful office in Redwood City?
We do. We're in like a 2 to 3 day a week model. And
how are people enjoying it? What's the reaction?
They're telling me it's good. And I mean, I think I can see happiness, you know, from a distance. There's a lot of benefits to remote. We actually still have a large remote, contingent in Box. But I do think having hubs, getting people together, you know, we're in New York, we're in Austin, we're in Chicago, we're in SF and Redwood City and then internationally. And so I think having convening place where you can, you know, spitball on ideas, you know, get mentored, you know, new and newer employees, you know, have a way of learning the craft and the trade. I think these are all important things. Does it need to be 5 days a week? Probably not. But I do think, you know, having people come together is really important. So we're getting the benefits of that.
Yeah, I'm going back to an office. I'm actually looking for a space in San Mateo now because I'm like, I just don't want to be at home anymore. I want to hang out with founders more. I want to do this in person again.
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, be able to do some in-person interviews, have lunch with the person after, and just, you know, see more people. It's just like so dystopian.
Yeah,
to be only remote. It's just.
I think that's the thing. Is like we got into this battle of like, oh, it's remote versus the office, and it's you know, even from our remote people, they love that. I'm speaking, you know, generally, but they love that we have offices because when they then come into town, oh, their colleagues are there and they can see them, and so it's, you know, it's not like these things have to be these extreme polarizing topics that I think we've turned them into. So
yeah, the finance people in New York are like, everybody get back to the office.
Right.
You know, every day you have to suffer. And then like they're in Italy and Aspen for 4 months.
Hamptons,
and I'm
exactly.
I'm like, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, I guess you can take a helicopter to work, so it's all good. All right, everybody. Yeah. Follow Aaron on the Twitter, LEVIE. Sign up for box.com. If you're looking for a great job and a great boss and just a legendary company, go to box.com, look for their careers page and you get a job.
I always like to build you up
at the end.
I appreciate that. That's great. I'm glad
you're still hiring, right? You got some job.
We are. Yeah. I mean, yeah. the boss credentials that you just gave me, I think, were a little bit overstated, but appreciate it. So
I've known you for over a decade. You've been on this pod for over a decade now. You're a fun guy. You're thoughtful. You make fun great products. So it's a good place to work, folks. And you can learn, right? You can learn from a legend. All right. We'll see you all next time.
You will learn in person.
Yeah, all right. Exactly.
See you, Jason.
All right. We'll see everybody next time. Bye-bye.